This week, a look at the prior bad acts of an Indiana sheriff's deputy and a court victory for a California cop watcher. This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of June 8th, 2006. I'm Ron Anisich with your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption.
If I order an internal investigation, there's a reason for that. And with 129 sworn officers, you do expect cooperation during the internal investigation. If we don't take a firm stance, I think we set a precedent for the future that other officers can just fail to cooperate and maybe get a slap on the wrist.
St. Joseph's County, Indiana Sheriff's Deputy Andrew Taggin was, along with Deputy Ryan Houston and South Bend Police Officer James Buford, placed on paid leave 3 weeks ago and had his gun and badge taken away while an investigation is conducted. Superiors remain tight-lipped about the reason for the suspensions and the investigation. The investigation is believed to be connected to a single incident which involved all three officers. The sheriff announced this week that he is seeking the dismissal of Taggin and Houston at a hearing to be held on January 5th. He cites failure to cooperate with the investigation as the reason for the dismissal. Taggin has a history of abuse which has become relevant during this investigation. This week, I spoke with Dennis and Eugenia Robinson of South Bend, Indiana. In 2002, Deputy Taggin came to their home. Dennis Robinson, who had recently had heart surgery, was beaten and pepper sprayed by the deputy. Robinson's injuries were severe enough that they would not admit him to the county jail in his condition, so he was sent to a hospital before being returned to the jail for the night. He suffered his first heart attack hours after being released from jail.
We received a telephone call from a telephone solicitor in Florida. He works for the Association of Chiefs of Police. And he asked to speak to my wife, who had already gone to bed. And I just told him no and hung up. And then, like speed dial, he called back and asked to speak to my wife again. And I told him no again and hung up. He did that about four times, and I finally got pissed off. So he calls, because we got a South Bend address, he calls South Bend City, who in turn calls St. Joe County. And I heard this recording in when I went to court that I was whooping on her. The guy asked, is he whooping on her? And I mean, he says you ought to send a car out to check it out. And when he calls St. Joe County, he says, I'm whooping on her. And those are his exact words as far as I can recall.
So let me get this absolutely straight then. A person who's a telephone solicitor.
Yep.
Calls your house.
Yep.
From Miami, Florida, this guy's calling from.
And you guys are in Indiana.
Yeah.
And he, because your wife's asleep, you don't want to bother waking her up or whatever, being the good husband.
Yeah.
And there's no need to bother her. It's a telephone solicitor.
Yeah. Right.
Most people see them as an annoyance.
They are.
He placed a call to your local law enforcement because he, for reasons that aren't really clear, presumably because your husband is not going and waking you up for every telephone salesperson who calls. He calls the authorities and they actually do respond. Do they phone you?
Yes.
And what do you...
I don't think he went through the 911. I think he called directly to the dispatcher at South Bend City.
And how did they respond?
real aggressively.
By phone at first, right?
Yeah, they called me at first, and as far as I know, this is just somebody else calling up and getting shitty on the telephone.
Okay.
So I didn't let that dispatcher the county dispatcher speak to my wife either. See, the city dispatcher said that I was whipping on my wife. And, of course, I wasn't.
How did that go? The dispatcher calls you. What do they say?
Just, can I speak to your wife? I think it was the third phone call. I may have had the phone away from my ear when she identified herself as a county police officer. I'm not sure they didn't just jack around with the tape or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't hear her identify herself as a county police officer. I just thought it was another person calling up on a phone and getting shitty wanting to talk to my wife. No, you ain't going to talk to my wife. Simple as that. Goodbye.
So they then send these two deputies to your home.
Yeah.
Describe that.
Well, when they came to the door, I had stepped out. I was going to stop him before they got to the house because my wife sleeps naked.
Huh.
And she had just realized that they were coming. So I stepped outside the door to stop them before they got to the house. And I put my hand up like, whoa, you know, just whoa. Now, Officer Tagon took a step back. I didn't touch him. He took a step back. And then the other police officer tried to go around me. And I did the same thing to him. Whoa, you know, if they'd give me 10 seconds, I'd have said my wife ain't dressed. Wait a minute. But when I went whoa to the second police officer, Tagon hit me. And then it was just off to the races.
So, when you say off to the races, first of all, where did he hit you first?
Side of my head in my ear area. I had a bloody ear.
And then when you say go to the races,
yeah, I went to hitting him back.
Oh, okay. So you're defending yourself at that point.
Yes, I am.
I imagine that there's two of them, one of you. They've got guns, maybe.
Big boys.
Yeah. And so I'm guessing they got the better of you.
Didn't take them long. They sprayed me with pepper spray, and they sprayed me good and hard with pepper spray. And as I was down on my face, they beat me with fists in my back. And I had open heart surgery not too long before that, and one of them collapsed, and they put a stent in. And because my arteries aren't good anyway, they didn't put it in good. And when they beat me in my back, the fleshy part of my back, it just knocked that stent out of whack. And about 30 hours later is when I had my first heart attack.
So you, after being beaten by the police, I imagine they put you in handcuffs?
Yes.
Did they allow you to receive any medical treatment?
No, they first took me to jail, and medical staff at the jail refused me. They wouldn't let them lock me up.
Now, just to be clear about what we're talking about here, because this is not the same from state to state. Sometimes when you're put into jail, the people who are going to be taking you into custody have the right to refuse to take you into custody if they consider that you have a medical problem that requires treatment in a hospital. So in this case, they took you to the jail, which is the county jail, right?
Yeah.
And they don't let you in?
Nope.
You're obviously in pretty bad shape.
There were two female medical people there.
Mm-hmm.
And they took one look at me and said, no, take him to the hospital.
Just by looking at you?
Oh, yeah, just by looking at me. They didn't.
He was beat up.
They didn't offer you any medical assistance on the spot?
No, huh?
I tried to call the ambulance. When the front door opened, I heard Denny open the front door. Our bedroom is not 20 foot from the front door.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard the door open, and I heard the siren, but it just didn't click with me that they were coming here. Who would call the police on us, and for what? So I just threw on, like, one of those T-shirt thingies, you know, the, you know, nightgown kind of T-shirt jobby things,
uh-huh.
And came out the bedroom to the front door. And when I opened, you know, my only thought is I'm going to have to stick my head out here and say, you know, here I am, what's the problem? And instead, when I opened the door, there Denny is, face down, bleeding. Two cops on him. They're trying to handcuff him, telling him quit resisting. And when I stepped out, because when I opened the door, I was like just shocked. And so I stepped out onto the front porch, and I just started screaming at the cops. And I said, what are you guys doing? He's a heart patient. Get off of him. And when I said that, I couldn't breathe. And my eyes were watering. And I'm like, did you guys spray something? And one cop said yes, and one cop said no.
What did Taggin say? Yes,
no.
Or yeah, okay.
And I immediately turned around and came back in my front door to try to call 911 to get an ambulance for Denny. I knew he was going to be in trouble. He had had too many, you know, like he said, he had the bypass and all that stuff already. I knew he was going to be in trouble. It was, you know, ridiculous what they had just done to him. And I knew he was going to be in trouble. I just knew it. And not, and I don't mean law trouble. I mean heart trouble, health trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And when I tried to call 911, my phone wouldn't work. And it was like echoing back at me. And I'm like, what the crap? And Taggin followed me in the house. And there was no lights on in our house at all. The only thing that was on was the TV in the living room here. And I heard him say, I've got it. And he was talking into that little microphone thing that they have, like, on their shoulder, okay?
Radio.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm trying to call the ambulance here. I said, you know, I need an ambulance for him. I said, he's, you know, just, you know, no. I mean, I was stuttering and stammering. I was just in shock. I couldn't believe what was going on. So he starts, like, taking a flashlight and, you know, looking around our house and stuff. And he's like, what's going on here? And I was, you know, crying by that time. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, there's nothing going on here. I said, I was in bed. And he says, just, he's really, really tall. And he just, like, stood over me and was just screaming at me and saying, you better tell me what's going on here. I want to know now what's going on here. And I'm like, I told you nothing. I was in bed. What are you talking about? I said, I've got to get an ambulance. You know, why won't my phone work? And then he goes, well, I'm going to have to check you over. And I'm like, check me over for what? And he proceeded to take his flashlight and check me over. Well, I've got nothing on but a T-shirt anyway. And you know,
so you're saying you felt violated by that?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They could have, you know, at least called a female officer or something.
Sure.
You know? But he did that right here in my living room. And, you know, Denny's outside, and they wouldn't allow me to talk to him, like, after that or anything. I just put my arms out to my sides. It's like, you know, this guy was going to do what he wanted, how he wanted. He was in total control of everything that went on from that point on. My, you know, concern as a wife for what they had done, their thing, that was just all lost. When he interfered with my phone call, it was like something clicked in my mind, and I realized that it was over for us. It was just, you know, nothing we said or did was going to work that night.
So Denny was taken to the hospital?
Yes, I did not know that. They told me they were taking him to the jail, because I went outside then. I mean, you know, the hell with the modesty at that time. I had went outside and tried to talk to him, and they wouldn't let me talk to him. They were, you know, get away from him. You know, you're not going to talk to him. And Taggin says, you know, we're taking him downtown, you know, whatever. And I'm like, okay, Denny. I remember my last words to him. I yelled, because we have a 90-foot driveway, so they had quite a stretch to get him out to the car. And I just turned around and I said, Denny, I'll be there to get you. And So, to my knowledge, they were taking him to the jail. I called the jail at, like, you know, we're only 15, 20 minutes at the most from the jail. I called down there. Nope, they've got no Dennis Robinson. So I waited a few more minutes. I called again. Nope, they've got no Dennis Robinson. Waited a few more minutes. Called again. Nope, they've got no Dennis Robinson. They don't know what I'm talking about. So I called my son, who is 35. You know, I'm 54, so we're not teenagers. And I called my son, and I said, Jerry, I said, you cannot believe. I said, you're not going to believe what just happened here. And I told him what happened, and I said they were taking Denny down to the jail. And I said, but he's not there. And so he called down there to the jail, and he said, look, Denny's an old man. He said, he's got a lot of heart problems. He said, I don't know what all went on. He said, but you need to tell my mom where he's at and what's going on. And they told him that they refused him, that he was being taken to the hospital. And he called me back and told me that they were taking him to the hospital. So I called the hospital. I called every, like, couple minutes until I finally got a hold of somebody because nobody would talk to me, and it was Tagon that kept coming to the phone. And he kept telling me that I could not come to the hospital, that I needed to stay by the phone, that when, you know, it was time for Dane to be released, I needed to be there to get the phone call. Now, I'm kind of naive on that stuff. I don't have a record. I don't have any experience with the police other than a speeding ticket. I didn't know, and I was so, I don't know how to describe it. I was afraid to leave. I was afraid to go to the hospital. And so I called every hour on the hour to try to find out what was going on. And Tagon kept coming to the phone and telling me, oh, they're going to give him a couple stitches. They'll just be a couple more minutes, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So I waited and waited and waited.
So how long did you spend at the hospital then, Dennis?
I was at the hospital. Well, the incident here happened around 8 o'clock, and I was there past 11. I know it was between 11 and 12 that they got me out of the hospital.
And they took you to jail?
And they took me directly to jail, yeah.
How long were you in jail for?
Overnight. That evening, the next evening, they came by, and charges had been dropped to misdemeanors. I was charged with felonies, but the charges were dropped to misdemeanors.
What were the original charges?
Felony assault on police officers.
And the misdemeanors that you were eventually charged with?
I don't know what they were called. I don't know what they called them.
I had taken his medications. Okay, he never saw a doctor at the hospital.
Nope.
Oh.
Never saw a doctor. And
Is that normal? Is that normal?
Not if you ask me. It is. My blood pressure is up 230.
And you were being at least monitored?
There was a nurse at the jail that monitored him all night long.
Okay.
But they never did anything. And I kept saying, look, he's got, I think at the time he was on like 7 or 8 different medications.
It wasn't quite that many.
At least a handful. Mm-hmm. And I took his meds up to the jail the next day, about noon the next day, and told them that I needed him to have these meds. You know, he needs to have these. And I had to take him, of course, in the prescription bottles. And then that was about 12 o'clock, and by 3:30, he called me on the phone and said, they've dropped him to misdemeanors. You know, you come up with a bail, and I can get out. So
what was the bail like? Was it affordable? It was affordable, right?
It was $250.
Okay.
And there's not such a thing. We don't have bondsmen here.
Okay.
So they don't like post a $10,000 bond where you got to come up with that type of thing. You know, it's $250. It was $250 cash because it was misdemeanor, dropped to misdemeanor. So I went and got the money and went up to the jail and got him out. And
has there been a trial where have you been to court for these charges?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. They approached me if I plead guilty and apologize to the police officers, they would not put me on probation. It's being on probation, but not probation. You don't call in or you don't show up or nothing. What it was bullshit. Is what it was. And I just absolutely was not going to apologize to those two police officers. There was absolutely nothing going on there.
No, of course not.
So we just ended up going to trial.
And how did that go for you?
They found me guilty of assaulting police officers and not guilty of resisting arrest.
That's interesting.
Yes, it is, isn't it? This was a jury trial, by the way.
Did you, you weren't, I'm going to guess you weren't sentenced to jail time?
No, time served, I think, is what it went down. I spent probably less than, well, about 30 hours in jail, or overnight in jail, and that was it. And the judge said, sentenced to time served, and just let me walk.
No probation?
No probation.
$25 fine.
$25.
$25 fine and time served, I think, yeah.
Because this, from when this happened to where the trial was like a year.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The judge asked that, you know, he had had the heart attack and, you know, all this stuff. And the judge asked Denny, he said, how do you want, you know, how do you want this? Because Tagon, he let his, like, himself be known there in court that you could tell he was a prick. And I think that
think that the jury noticed that?
I think the judge did.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when it came right down to it, and he asked Denny, you know, what do you want, Mr. Robinson? Because everybody had their say-so. And Denny just said, it's been a long, long year. I just want this over with. And the judge said, $25 fine. Boom, that was it. It was over.
Now, did you, after this, or at any point, file a complaint against the sheriff's deputies?
We had a lawyer. We had bought and paid for a lawyer. We spent probably $10,000 on this deal.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not mistaken, I can't prove this or anything, but I just think he just sold me out to the cops. They threatened him or something. I don't know, but he just sold me out to him.
Well, what do you mean? What happened?
Well, after the trial, and they came back with the guilty assault police officers, not guilty of resisting arrest, my lawyer looked at me and said, they can't do that. And we will appeal this. So we cough up some more money, and he sends in the appeal. Now, when we get the appeal back, they've changed their story again, and there was another little letter in there from my lawyer saying he would not care to continue this. He dropped me as a client. We were going to sue him. See, we thought we could sue them, but frankly, until I was in court, I didn't hear that recording until I was in court, and we really had a lawsuit against the South Bend City dispatcher. He's the one that lied. He's the one that stretched the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my lawyer just sold me out. I had my first heart attack 30 hours after I got out of jail, or after the incident.
Yeah, after the incident. He got out of jail at 3:30 that night. I went up
3:30 or 5, and I had my heart attack at 1 o'clock that morning, or 11 o'clock that evening.
It was 11 o'clock that night. We had just went to bed. We were talking about, you know, what had happened. We couldn't believe what had happened and, you know, all the crap and blah, blah, blah. And we just laid down and were trying to go to sleep and, you know, couldn't go to sleep because just so much had happened. And I think we finally dozed off, and it was about 11 o'clock, and he's up on the side of the bed, and he's, you know, in the middle of a massive heart attack. And that's why they didn't want him in the jail. I think that's why they dropped it to misdemeanor and got him out of there, because he had such a poor health history. I come walking up there finally with, you know, his medications as proof that, look, this guy's in bad shape. They let his blood pressure be in the 200s for, like, the whole night. Nobody did anything about it. No medical attention. Didn't see a doctor when they did take him to the hospital. They just wanted his ass out of there because they didn't want him to have a heart attack in the hospital or in the jail.
Are you satisfied with how this ended?
No, absolutely not.
No.
Are you somewhat encouraged that Officer Taggin's off the streets for the time being?
Well, hopefully he's going to be shown for what he is, and everybody's going to know.
Okay.
There's an older officer that came out here. My neighbor's cows got loose, and I called down to the sheriff's department because they, you know, they were, like, everywhere. And this older officer came up here, and he knew of the incident. He knew, they know our address. They know, how do I say? It's like you can tell that there's been talk about what happened. It didn't just go unnoticed down there at the sheriff's department. It's like nobody just believed that, you know, the cops would do this, that, no, we had to have done something. And I'm like, we didn't do anything.
Departments which fail to deal with problem officers early often must deal with a more serious situation down the road. Across the U.S., some police departments are now implementing systems to track problem officers for this reason. There is a certain body of evidence which suggests that such systems are effective in preventing police abuse. However, there is also anecdotal evidence in the mainstream media that some of these systems have been poorly implemented. Burnaby Santillan is a former police officer who started a Cop Watch chapter in Reedley, California, after becoming a police abuse victim himself. The Reedley Police Department attempted to get a restraining order preventing him from filming them, but it was dropped. This week, a judge ordered the Reedley Police Department to repay Santillan's legal fees connected to the restraining order in a precedent-setting decision. Because of this decision, police departments in California will not be able to obtain such court orders against cop watchers on the grounds that it violates their First Amendment rights. I spoke with Santillan earlier today.
I'm pleased that I prevailed in that. And, just shows them that they can't, you know, bully people around.
You were a police officer at one time.
Yes, I was a police officer for a little over 11 years.
In Sanger, California.
Yeah, for the city of Sanger. I started out as a reserve. Actually, I started out as a police explorer with a little local police department here in Dinuba, California. And then I went to the academy in 88. In 1989, I got hired on as a reserve at the Reedley Police Department.
So what happened to drive you away from your job in Sanger?
95, I retired, and pretty much after, like I said, a little over 11 years, I just got burnt out and got tired of all the politics and got tired of, the officers, messing with the Hispanic community. And
so it's fair to say you were pretty concerned about what you saw on the job.
Yeah, I was.
You at one point decided in Reedley to start a Cop Watch chapter, but there is a specific set of events that led you to that point. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened to you to make you think that was necessary?
Well, what happened was that I drove city bus here for the city of Reedley for about 5 years, and during that time, I met a lot of people, and what happened was that I'm still going through court on this specific case, so I can't get, too much into it. But what happened was they're alleging that I stole an identity of a coworker, and in fact, he gave me permission to use his name and information. And one thing led to another where the officers accused me of stealing this person's identity, and it went on for for about almost 8 months where they were investigating it. Finally, I guess the DA finally filed the charges, and they came in. They had a warrant for my arrest. They came to my house, and I had just recently had a surgery on my left shoulder when this happened. So as they were trying to cuff me, I told them, I wasn't unable to, bend my hand, put my hands behind my back because of my recent surgery.
Now, you're a former police officer, so you know what they have to do, and you know that they, I guess you're aware that they can, if they want to, use their discretion and maybe what, handcuff you around the front?
Right.
That's what you were after.
That's what I was after. So after, pleading with them, and these guys were grabbing my arms, twisting them, and bending them, finally after pleading for several minutes, telling them, just cuff me in the front, one of them finally said, yeah, just go ahead and cuff me in the front. But as they're leading me out the door, one officer has me by one arm, another officer has me by another arm, and a third officer is pushing me from behind. And while they're walking me towards the patrol car, these guys are bending my arms and twisting and stuff, and I kept complaining to them, you guys are hurting me. And while they didn't listen, finally a uniformed officer that was there finally pushed one of the detectives over and grabbed a hold of my one of my arms. And he twisted even further, so I kept telling him, you're really hurting me. Stop doing that. Well, at that time, he looked over at me and told me basically, shut the effing up, and just twisted my arm and just slammed me to the ground and landed on my shoulder. And that's where it all started.
Were you surprised to be treated that way?
Oh, yeah, pretty much, because I was still a city employee, and these guys knew who I was. I mean, I was no... Right, I was no, I wasn't gonna flee anywhere. I was no risk. I was no high risk person.
And they knew you were a former police officer.
Yeah, they knew I was a former police officer. They knew all this stuff and the way they came at me. And then what really got me is when I looked over towards my front porch where I was lying on the roadway on the floor, on the hot floor, on the ground. I looked over and I see my 5-year-old boy just crying his head off. It's like, man, these guys just. They went overboard.
Yeah, definitely very low compassion for not only a fellow human being, but a former law enforcement officer.
Exactly. And so after that, I immediately asked to requested an ambulance because I was in severe pain. I started having chest pains also. Requested for an ambulance. It took them a while to call one. My daughter came out and confronted the officers, telling them, why'd you throw my dad? And they told her, you basically step back or they're going to arrest her too. So I told her, grab the cell phone and you call 911 and get an ambulance over here because these guys aren't doing it. So she got on the phone, dialed 911, and by that time they already had said, we already called one. So as I was lying on the floor there on the hot asphalt, this was in August, so it was hot down here. It was about a little over 100.
Mm-hmm.
I get up and I try to stand up and lean on one of the detectives' cars, and one of the detectives, Hector Elliman, tells me, don't lean on my car. You can sit on the floor if you want. So it's like, man, just forget it. I just moved away and laid on the grass there. I'm afraid they're going to do something else to me.
So you decide at some point you're going to react to this by monitoring the activities of the Reedley Police Department. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came to see that as an option? I understand you were hooked up with some people in Fresno that started watch group there.
Yeah, so what happened was when, after all this incident happened, I got bailed out, went home, and I was watching the news and I saw that Fresno had organized a cop watch. So I started looking into it on the internet and found out, Berkeley had one, Phoenix. I mean, it was everywhere. So I started looking at what they did, and I said, man, I'm going to do this here. And I bought me a scanner, got my camera, and I do it a little bit different than Fresno does. Fresno kind of, is laid back. I actually go out and videotape the officers. I photograph them. I keep my distance. I don't interfere. And I was doing this for a while, and one day in I think it was January or February, I get this package delivered to me by a process server, and I open it up, and lo and behold, they filed a restraining order against me, the whole entire police department.
Now, a process server, for those people who might not know, are there people who deliver, who serve people with court documents?
Correct, yeah, subpoenas and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I started looking into this, and I go, oh my God, they want me, I only had 16 days to respond to this. And it's like, I don't know, you know, the saying, you know, I had to stay away 100 yards away from them. I had to stay away from their families. I had to do all this stuff. And
you hired a lawyer.
So basically, yeah, so I had to go shop around and see, you know, how I was going to fight this. And I was going to do it on my own because, I mean, a lawyer was expensive.
Yeah.
So I started calling the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild. So they turned me into, you know, onto a few lawyers, but a lot of them wanted a lot of money up front, which, you know, I didn't have. So...
But you did get one eventually.
Yeah, the last person I went to was Charles McGill here in Fresno, California, mm-hmm. and I'm glad I found him because he was a godsend. And
he seems to have taken on. It seems as though he may have taken on police departments for some of his other clients.
Oh yeah, he's a criminal defense lawyer. Not only that, I guess he's had some issues with the local Fresno PD officers as well. And he was, an expert in restraining orders. So immediately he took it, and the first day we went to court, he, on the way out, he filed his anti-SLAPP lawsuit against the city of Reedley.
Which is what exactly?
A SLAPP suit is I don't know the exact terminology, is a strategic. It's against public participation and something in that effect. And it basically is it's used when, you know, governments, big corporations or anything try to shut people up when they're exercising their First Amendment right to free speech.
Oh, okay.
So that's what it is. It basically puts a stop to the whole lawsuit or the whole, you know, civil injunction.
You ended up with... some pretty hefty legal fees, despite the fact that you found a lawyer that was fairly reasonable for you.
Right.
And you went to court. I guess first we should talk about, is that how you dealt with the restraining order? From that point on, the restraining order was a non-issue. The city dropped it, I gather?
Yeah, what happened was, even when the city went after the temporary restraining order, automatically the judge denied it, because and set it for a hearing. We went to the hearing, and my attorneys needed more time, so the judge, you know, gave us more time because my attorney needed approximately 5 to 10 days of a trial time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you were in and out of court quite a bit. I've been in touch with you for a few months now, and
right.
And you seem to have been spending a lot of time there.
So what happened was... before we had to go to the to trial, the city went ahead and dismissed the restraining order with prejudice. So at that time, the clerk accidentally removed the anti-SLAPP suit motion also, which would give us, you know, to recoup our attorney's fees. So what we had to do is refile another civil suit, and that's where we went to court on May the 4th, and the judge usually rules from the bench, but this time, he took it under submission because of the nature of the case.
And he gave you a fairly lengthy written decision, a 10-page...
Yeah, 10 pages, a 10-page opinion, and awarded us, I guess it was like $8,100.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Now, I understand your lawyer has offered to accept a payment of 50% of that amount with a certain condition attached to it. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, my attorney offered the city of Reedley to he would cut his fees 50% if each and every officer would take a class. Administered by my attorney and his wife, who is also a lawyer, on the Bill of Rights, on the First Amendment and constitutional law. And he would cut it down, you know, to half of it.
And has he had a response yet from...
No response yet. No response from the city. Excuse my kid.
That's okay.
Yeah, no response from the city yet. They have... The city has 30 days to either... accept the offer or pay the fees.
And you expect they'll probably come up with the money rather than have to...
Oh, yeah, because to them, I think to them, they think it's a slap in the face to them. That's the way, you know, most cops think.
Well, I wanted to talk to you a bit about, you know, the what this means for other cop watch groups. Have there been other cop watch groups that have had to face restraining orders from, like the one that you were facing?
That I'm aware of, I think I'm the first one that I'm aware of, and I think my case is just going to, I mean, it sets precedent for all the other cop watchers out there that, you know, they're not going to have to worry about the police departments or cities trying to file restraining orders against them,
But there are reasonably other ways for the police to interfere with cop watch groups other than taking them to court. Can you talk about any, maybe, of the some of the other troubles that some of the other groups you're aware of facing?
Yeah, the main one they usually face is, you know, interfering. They'll make up, the police will make up some, you know, ridiculous, they'll make up a reason to try to arrest cop watchers, saying, you know, they're getting too close, not listening. But it's my understanding that a lot of the police departments now are writing policy towards, you know, when officers confront cop watchers.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much, you know, they tell them, you know, the policy is, you know, you leave them alone, and they're there to observe, and only where in extreme circumstances you can tell them to back off, you know, if someone's out there with a gun or something.
I've certainly heard many stories where people have been accused of interfering with police officers in the line of duty when they're only there to watch. But just to be clear, people have a right to observe the police, right?
That's correct, yeah. Our First Amendment, especially in the United States, that, you know, that gives us the right to, you know, to observe and watch the police, or, you know, police officers are paid by taxpayers, and, you know, they are public officials, and we need to hold them accountable. And this is one way of doing it, is by watching them and make sure they're not out there violating people's rights and, you know, abusing their authority and treating everybody with respect, which is that's all we ask for.
And how important would you say the role of cop watch groups is in keeping police officers in line and behaving within policy? Would you say it's been fairly effective?
Oh, yeah. In my case, it has, because so far, when I'm out there, I see it, a big difference in how they treat the people. Not only that, I've seen a big difference in the police department and how they changed their complaints process. You know, they're a lot more friendly. You don't have to go in and, you know, ask for a complaint form and have to talk to somebody. They have them right there in the front lobby, and they've been completely changed, and they're more, you know, community friendly.
Do you have relatively decent civilian oversight of the police there?
That's my next, that's what I'm working on right now with the city council, trying to get a citizens review board implemented, because at this time there is nothing like that, and, you know, they investigate themselves, and I think that's kind of hard to do when, you know, most of them are friends, and how can you investigate your own friend and not be biased?
Well, Burnaby, I just want to thank you once again not only taking the time to speak with us, but congratulations on your victory in court too. It's good news for cop watchers, definitely in your state, if not right across the country.
Bad cop, cop, no, donut.
Before we leave you this week, I would like to play you a recording of Hamilton County, Tennessee Sheriff's Deputy Ezra Harris performing the U.S. National Anthem at a memorial service for a fallen officer. This recording was prepared, but not broadcast, by a best left unnamed Chattanooga television station, thanks to the individual who was nice enough to send it along.
Oh, see, can you see by the dawn's early light, while so hell the twilight at the last gleaming was bright, who brought thee us fire? and the rock is red glare, bombs bursting in air, gave to the night that the stars were still there. Oh, say,
please. Bad Cop No Donut is produced at CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto and can be heard on campus, community, pirate, and internet radio stations throughout the United States, Canada, and elsewhere. This show is available freely for nonprofit use. You can download the show, sign up for our email newsletter, support the show, read news, and find out more about this program at the show's website, www.badcopnodonut.fm. We value your input. Please send your comments or story ideas to ron@ckln.fm. Thanks to everyone who sent in articles for this week's program. I'm Ron Anisich. Thanks for listening.
A lot of people, I hear these people talking about, yeah, you know, cops do this, they have their job, yeah, but what they don't realize is, you know, what about us? One of my friends got rolled on by a cop, got away with it. You know, they just dumped him right there in the attic. He was beat up. They did the same thing to me, you know. We were drunk one night, hanging around in the park with my friends. They pull out the guns. You know, we're not even armed. They pull out guns talking about getting the, you know, get on the car, get on the car. And they put one of my friends on the top of the hood. And what do they say? They turn on the engine, making them burn, making the hood burn his face. Like you said, if they kill a cop, I wouldn't give a shit. I had a rib broken because of them. And they let me go like that. You know, what's the justice in that?
We cannot have a civil society, a civilized society, if we allow a bunch of people to go around like a bunch of cowboys beating up people.
People can start being aware that they don't have to submit to search and seizures. They don't have to have their photographs taken over. They don't have to be pulled over and just harassed for no reason whatsoever.
Well, this guy got clubbed 27 times. They said he was lying on the ground, and they said, well, he was resisting arrest. How are you going to resist arrest lying on the ground?
But, I know.
And they kept clubbing him. 27 times they busted him in the head and over his ribs and everything else.
When I moved to Houston in 1968, the police had just stomped Bobby Joe Connor to death. A few years later, they shot down Carl Hampton on Dowling Street, July 26, 1970, and it has gone on and on and on with illegal activities by the police. We saw the police harass, this was like 11:30 at night, harassing a young man who was going down the street in a wheelchair, and he was yelling at them, and they were yelling at him.
Oh, we've been watching the cops a long time. We've been watching them harass, harangue, arrest, and abuse our young people, and they could point to where the hanging tree was in Founders Park on West Dallas Street. Some of the old ones even contend that the officers wore blue during the day and white at night, and we've been watching a long time, I see very young people, particularly young men, black and brown men, being targeted, harassed, and what the old folks call writing the name down, which is the beginning of getting these kids arrested and taking their futures and robbing us of our children. The police in Houston and throughout the country are attacking communities as if it didn't matter, and if they could do it and just get away with it.
You have a right to watch the police. Mm-hmm. We as citizens, we as taxpayers,
and a responsibility.
Have a responsibility, absolutely, to observe what's going on with police. Police depend on their anonymity, and they depend on people assuming that whatever they're doing is right. The police aren't always right, and there are a lot of police who are being very abusive of their power.
Yes.
And we need to be addressing that in a very open manner.
Because in many communities, the police are nothing but occupying forces.
Exactly.
We have a whole new segment of our society that's been targeted by police, namely the Arab communities, the South Asian communities, the Muslim communities.
And people who look like they may be.
And we can either sit in our homes and hope that this thing changes, or we can start reaching out to others mm-hmm. and start organizing.
We want an immediate end to the police brutality that our people are confronted by every single day, every single week, every single month, every single year across the land.
The police were told that I had nothing in my hands. It's in the 911 transcript. So why did they think that they needed to come at me with loaded handguns?
But we don't want to walk around here in a police state giving people the right to think that they can take our life or break our limb or bust our...
Video surveillance, strip searches, political activity by officers. Toronto seems to be in a situation where the police force has not been particularly well governed for the last decade. And it's doing many things that people are very unhappy about. Racial profiling. There have been many, many complaints that racial profiling occurs by the Toronto police. And the Toronto Star, which is our leading newspaper in Toronto, actually did a study on it 2 years ago and showed conclusively that the data indicated that racial profiling was a fact of life. Strip searches. There was a very strong decision out of the Supreme Court of Canada in 2001 indicating that strip searches should only occur in extraordinary situations, but they continue in Toronto to be almost ordinary. About a third of the people who get arrested seem to be strip searched. There's actually hostility now between the police force and City Hall, the way that police act in demonstrations, that they aren't supporting people's attempt to try and express opinion, but they seem actively to be trying to suppress it. And there was a demonstration in 2001 in Toronto when the police decided to actually arrest people before the demonstration began, sort of in a preventative kind of fashion. And they arrested four young people. One was 14, one was 15. I think the other two were over 16 years of age. And they put them in a paddy wagon, and they locked them there for 9 hours. They were all handcuffed, the handcuffs behind their back, and all of them were kept in that position, except for one. One person, his arms went into spasm because of the way he was handcuffed, and so they re-handcuffed him with his hands in front. But they were kept in that for 9 hours, and then after the demonstration was over, they were released. No charges or anything like that. They laid a complaint. And the complaint was processed by the Toronto Police Force. We have a complaint system in Ontario where the police investigate themselves. And so the police investigated themselves about this complaint and concluded that the complaint was not substantiated. At which point, the four complainants then appealed that matter to the Ontario Civilian Commission on Police Services, which is a provincial body, OCOPS as it's called. OCOPS looked at the matter and decided to try and get the parties together to try and talk about a solution to the problem. And in August, they actually came out with a decision where the police apologized for what was done. The police actually documented the fact that they had arrested these people, kept them in a paddy wagon for 9 hours, no washroom facilities or anything like that. And at least one of the people had to pee on the floor of the paddy wagon. And police admitted that they finally just released these people without charge and so forth. But at the end of the day, they apologized. Now, the police also said that they've brought in what they call a mass arrest policy in situations like this. And unfortunately, the policy is not made public. The police will not release it. They say it's an operational policy, and therefore it can't be made public. But it seems to say that if the police do this preventative arrest in the future, then they'll have to have washroom facilities, and they'll have to have sort of supervise the people that they arrest. I personally believe that the police don't have the right to arrest people on a preventative basis. You can't go out and arrest people because you think they're going to do something. That's not a valid reason for arrest, but it looks like the mass arrest policy might do that. So it's very unusual to get such a clear apology and an admission that they did something wrong. But whether that means that this won't happen in the future, I frankly don't know. I believe that if they do have a mass arrest policy along the lines I've indicated, that is that they will arrest people on a preventative basis, but they'll give them washroom facilities. I don't think that's good enough because I don't believe that they should be arresting people on a preventative basis. You only arrest people when they've committed a crime or are just about to commit a crime. You don't arrest people because they're going to be part of a demonstration. One of the changes that has to be made in Toronto is that the operational policies have to be made public so we know what they are. The idea that the police are doing things according to policies that we can't get hold of doesn't make any sense. We found that in many cases the police are very, very heavy-handed. At this particular demonstration, the complaint mentioned, the apology mentions that there were 550 officers. Well, I'm not sure there were that many demonstrators. It was a relatively small demonstration, but we've often seen in terms of demonstrations in Toronto an overwhelming police presence with an overwhelmingly large array of guns, which we think is entirely inappropriate.